My guest is Anand Menon. Anand Menon is the director of the academic think tank, the UK in a Changing Europe. Welcome to the podcast, Anand.
Really nice to be here, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. So we're going to actually, the theme of the chat will be actually the UK in a Changing Europe. Before we get into some of the substance, maybe clarify some confusion out there. We all know by now that the historic funding of your organization has come to an end. And some people might be jumping to conclusion that you're gonna cease to exist. But what's happening? What is the status of the UK in a Changing Europe, and what are your plans for the future?
Well, our status is, I'm delighted to say, we've managed to get together the funding to keep us going for another year, partly thanks to King's College, partly thanks to another donor who, until the paperwork is signed and sealed, I won't name, but I will do later. And our plans are, I mean, we've got a lot of plans for the next few months because, of course, we've got the UK EU summit, we've got the NATO summit, we've got the world that Trump is making or unmaking. There's an awful lot going on. And actually, as you implied in your opening, it's taken 10 years, but our name finally makes some kind of sense because there is so much going on and so much that calls into question our basic assumptions about foreign policy, about bilateral relations, that I think this is going to be perhaps the most exciting year of our existence so far.
Right. Well, you've mentioned the EUK summit, 19th of May, it's all in our diaries. So let's start with that. What are your expectations of the summit? What do you think is going to come out of it?
I mean, the honest answer is I'm not really sure. Recently, the things we've been hearing and the things you've seen in the press would imply that our expectations should be increased some a little bit. That they're talking about going beyond just discussing in the economic sphere an SPS agreement. We're talking, those rumours about mutual recognition of conformity assessment and things that will significantly help move some of the frictions on trade. I think we all expect that a defence deal will be done. We'll wait and see what the details of that are. On the British side, I think there's a hope that it includes access to some of the procurement funds that the EU now has at its disposal. And of course, what we're not certain about is how much linkage there's going to be, how much linkage between, say, the economic stuff and a deal on fisheries quotas. And I suppose the other thing that we're just starting to hear rumours about are that the UK government is going to be perfectly relaxed about accepting dynamic alignment, not only in agriculture, but possibly even when it comes to emissions trading, to bring the UK and EU schemes into line with each other.
Do you have any sense that the UK, or even the EU for that matter, are trying to sort of manage expectations? There's talk about there being a so-called tunnel now, a lot happening under the surface, behind the scenes, whatever the metaphor is, and they're not talking too much about what might come out the summit, and what little is out there in the public domain, they're deliberately trying to downplay.
Yeah, I think there is an element of that. I mean, it doesn't stop the newspapers reporting stuff quite breathlessly. I think both sides are keen to downplay things. It's better to underpromise and overdeliver in politics as a rule. I think on the UK side as well, there's a slight sense of not wanting to discuss anything to do with Brexit or the reset before the local elections.
Right.
The summit happily happens after the local election, so there might be a bit more freedom to talk about it then. And whether this is a good or bad strategy is an interesting question because, of course, we've got a lot of experience of UK-EU negotiations over the last decade or so. It's not always the case that doing things in secret and then presenting them afterwards is a recipe for success. Keir Starmer has what Theresa May, of course, didn't, which is a massive great majority in Parliament, so that's nothing to worry about. But I mean, personally, I think if you're remaking the relationship of a bit more could have been done to prepare public opinion and to start to lead public opinion rather than running scared of it. But let's see what happens on the 19th. I mean, the other thing I would say about the 19th is it's not just about the 19th. This isn't an end point. Brexit is
No.
forever. The negotiations are forever. And as important and interesting as what they actually agree is whether there is a concrete timetable for what happens afterwards, if there are ambitions, milestones for further talks, further negotiations, maybe regular summits of this kind. So that'll be something to look out for as well, I think.
With the benefit of hindsight, do you think it was a mistake for it to be called a reset? I'm not quite sure where the idea came from, because it kind of raises expectations. And therefore, whatever happens at the summit, people say, well, that doesn't really amount to a reset, surely? Question mark.
I mean, I think if I were the Labour Party, I'd say with the benefit of hindsight, we got a massive great majority by using that language, partly by using that language. So it
Right.
worked. And they're no longer talking about a reset, interestingly enough. When Nick
Okay.
Thomas talks about now, he's talking about our new strategic alliance with the European Union. So I think I get the impression, though no one said so openly, that the reset word has been quietly dropped in favor of something that sounds a little bit bolder, actually, a strategic alliance.
Right. So you were saying then, whatever happened in terms of, maybe say, some kind of joint statement or communique on the day or the evening of the summit, what matters more maybe is what happened afterwards. You said a lot in the past that what's missing maybe historically since Brexit is some kind of structured organization to make sure that the two sides don't forget to talk to each other. What importance do you still attach to the idea of having sort of semi-official or totally official structures for this dialogue to be maintained?
I think it helps to have those sort of official institutionalized links. That means that we might meet at head of state or head of government level once a year. Ministers might meet regularly. I mean, if you look at something like the Franco-German Elysée Treaty and the provision that makes, I mean, they have joint cabinet meetings under the terms of that. I think, and talking to each other is never a bad thing. I think in a way, Donald Trump has helped provide that already, because one of the interesting things about 19th of May, 19th of May no longer stands out in our calendars in the way it did when it was first announced, because it seems like there's a summit every week.
Quite.
So, Keir Starmer's meeting his European colleagues is no longer headline news, because hardly a day goes by when he's not, it seems. So, in a sense, we have that, but I think it is worth institutionalizing it just to keep that regular pattern, regular timetable. And of course, having a timetable of summits means that politicians have to be willing to deliver something each time, and that keeps the momentum going.
So warming to then to this theme of changing Europe and the UK's place in this changing Europe environment, there is obviously the EU itself now is trying to handle and deal with all sorts of new situations they weren't a part of in the past. Obviously, we know what we're talking about. And these summits, you'll say, taking place almost every week, which are not maybe EU mandated, as it were. The EU is always represented through von der Leyen and Costa, the President of the European Commission, President of the European Council, but they take place alongside more official meetings. So, what importance do you think that these summits, either hosted by the Brits or hosted by the French, dealing with Ukraine in particular, the coalition, the willing type thing, are going to be the more of a feature in the future?
I mean, there are a lot of variables. In the sense, the key variable is what the United States does and what the United States becomes. I mean, if the United States really is going to say to the Europeans, over to you, you sort your own security out, we're going to have to meet more regularly. We're going to have to find institutions to do it. I mean, one of the things that's played to the advantage of Keir Starmer, I think, is the fact that when it comes to Ukraine and defence, you can't use the European Union as the coordinating organisation, partly because the EU doesn't really do the deployment of hard power at scale that we're talking about now, and partly, of course, because the EU is internally divided and there are some member states you don't want present at the meetings when you're discussing these things. So the EU is obviously a very, very important part of what's going on. I mean, one of the interesting questions for me around the summit is, what do EU member states mean when they say Europe? Do they mean the EU, or do they mean something broader? And for the Brits, I think that's key. For the future of European security, I think that's key. But again, the crucial question is where America lands. Does America land as being still an ally, but not willing to carry the burden it's carried historically for European security? Does it end up actually saying, you know what, you're on your own. We've got bigger fish to fry in China, so we're pulling troops out of Europe. We don't want much to do with NATO. Or, worst case scenario is, does America become a country against whom we need to build resilience? That is to say, in the worst case analysis, you shouldn't be buying kit from the Americans because they'll reserve the right to turn off the software. You can't use NATO because the Americans are all over NATO, and if you don't want them to hear what you're talking about, you can't use NATO anymore. I mean, we're still not clear where America lands. And I have to say that, talking about the coalitions of the willing, a lot of the discussions going on seem to me to be implicitly, at least, predicated on a belief that America will still be involved in policing a deal if there is one in Ukraine. Because it doesn't strike me that either the Brits or the French, who seem to be leading most of these conversations, is ready to deploy peacekeepers to Ukraine absent some sort of American, well, the term we use is backstop. I'm not sure what that means, but some sort of American guarantee.
It seems to be kind of common knowledge now on the record that both the President Trump and his Vice President JD Vance have no warm feelings about the European Union. On the contrary, do you see any signs if there's any kind of strategy, if they're thinking this through, of the Americans trying to, for example, dangle the possibility of a trade deal with the UK in order for their to get to produce a situation where the UK has to quote unquote choose between the US and the EU, or is that too simplistic?
There's no firm evidence of that as yet. I mean, there are certain, I mean, the one obvious area where there is a clear and obvious trade-off is agriculture and food standards.
Right.
Okay. The UK wants to negotiate this SPS agreement. If the US were to turn around and say the price you pay for having no tariffs is to allow chlorinated chicken, hormone-treated beef, whatever it may be, into your market, that puts an end to the talks with the European Union. So that's the clear trade-off. Then there are more sort of fuzzy, intangible trade-offs. For instance, if relations between the EU and the US deteriorate still further, and the UK is still seen to be saying, we're not choosing, we want to be friends with you, it wants to be friends with you as well, there might be some in the European Union who say, hang on a sec, you know, this for us is a struggle with the United States. And if you want a closer relationship with us, you're going to have to, if not choose a side, then at least be a lot less equivocal than you're being about who your main partner is. So there are dangers. I mean, my colleague Jill Rutter has just written a really nice piece for the House magazine in which he's saying that, you know, Keir Starmer is walking something of a tightrope here. And I think that's true.
Well, this tightrope, but so how sustainable is the tightrope? How long, all these metaphors, how long can he ride two horses? How sustainable is it before all of a sudden he's faced with a very stark choice that he can't avoid?
Yeah, I mean,
Stark.
it depends what the Americans do and what the Americans want, what relations between the US and the EU, how those develop. I mean, my fear has always been, I suppose, in terms of Keir Starmer being forced to choose, is that, you know, people like Nigel Farage are whispering into the ears of people in the administration while you're at it. And given that you hate the European Union, you should be trying to pull the United Kingdom away from the European Union. Now, if that's the thinking of the Trump administration, life gets difficult quite quickly for Keir Starmer, because it might be that they sort of insist on those sort of agricultural standards trade-offs as part of any trade deal.
So on this question of the relationship, EU-UK relationship post the summit, the 19th of May summit, what kind of scenarios can you envisage? What I ask the question because so much of the debate now, because we're getting quite close to the summit, it's less than a month's time, is maybe naturally the media talking about the problem areas. You mentioned fish, the SPS agreement, if it's actually agreed, the youth mobility scheme. I could go on and on. We talk about the issues where there are tensions, but could you imagine a world in which both sides realize that they have a common interest, common challenges, and they should be working on specific areas without being too naive, without any of these tensions?
I think, yes, in the area of defence and security, that is very obviously the case. It's far less the case in the economic realm. I mean, incidentally, I don't think they're going to sign and seal an SPS agreement at the summit.
All right.
My suspicion is that that will be one of the sort of, you know, next on the to-do list coming out of the summit, and that how firm the language is and what the milestones are will be sort of interesting indicators of how serious both sides are. But I think when it comes to economic relations, the asymmetry, the fundamental asymmetry, is that the EU is relatively happy with the status quo and the UK isn't.
Right.
Rachel Reeves is increasingly linking closer trading relations with the EU to her growth mission, which is, of course, the one central overriding mission of this government. And I'm not convinced yet that people in the UK have sufficiently taken on board the fact that we need to lure the European Union into doing something here. It's not self-evidently something they're thinking, we're going to have to do this.
Do you see any signs that of the groups outside that Downing Street but having been more effective in making their case? I'm not just talking about the well-established and well-known campaign groups, but the business community, for example, backbench Labour MPs, other voices, individual pundits and gurus, having any kind of impact on Keir Starmer, Rachel Reeves thinking?
I mean, it's very hard to sort of, you know, as anyone in a think tank can tell you, it's very hard to prove who's having an impact on whom.
Right.
What I would say is, you know, The Guardian today is reporting a letter signed by 60 or 70 backbench Labour
Yeah.
MPs pressing for a youth mobility deal. So MPs are starting to become more vociferous in the run-up to the summit. I'm sure business leaders are having these conversations. I mean, one of the problems at the moment is there are so many things going on that the SMMT, the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders, the last I heard, they were calling for a trade deal with the United States because they're very concerned not just about trade with the European Union, but also the tariffs with the United States. So in a sense, the summit isn't the sole focus of attention in a way we might have expected it to have been
Yeah.
when we first heard it was being called. But yeah, I'm sure business groups are talking to the government. I think the government is still running scared of what it sees as, what they used to call the hero voters, the people who are flirting with reform, maybe didn't come back to Labour at the last election. I mean, one of it's a strange thing to note when you've got a government with a majority of 170, but the Labour electoral coalition is very fragile, and Labour were elected on the lowest vote share of any government in this country. Okay, so it's strong but unstable, if I can paraphrase Theresa May, the current governing coalition. And I think, Labour planners are worried, and Labour planners don't want to upset potential Labour voting leave supporters, which makes them cautious, hence the red lines. And the problem there, of course, is one, the red lines can be misinterpreted. So I've lost count of the number of times that when a government minister's asked about a youth mobility scheme, they say, "We're not rejoining freedom of movement." And you just want to scream, "It's not bloody freedom of movement. There are visas." Okay,
Yes,
this
quite.
is so completely different to
It's
freedom of movement.
time limited as well.
Yeah. And the second thing is that, in terms of the growth mission, the real growth is via customs union and particularly single market, which are two things that the government has ruled out. So whatever we get over the next months or years in terms of overcoming some of the frictions implicit in the trade and cooperation agreement, they're not going to be economic game changers for this country in any way, shape, or form.
Right. What you mentioned at the beginning, the NATO summit, the upcoming NATO summit. Do you think the UK is still trying, going back to this, trying to ride two horses, be some kind of bridge between the United States and and Europe? And is there any signs from your perspective of the UK starting to countenance and envisage some kind of European pillar within NATO?
I mean, yes and yes, I think the simple answer is that, the UK, for very good reasons, is desperate to remain on good terms with the US and with the EU and to keep the US engaged in European security. At the same time, building up a European pillar of NATO, which basically means building up European capabilities so we can do more independent of the United States, makes perfect sense because, as we've been saying for years, the secular trend in American foreign policy is less focus on Europe, more focus on Asia. And that's not just a Donald Trump thing, that's an America thing. And of course, it's just done a lot more brutally under Donald Trump. But then, of course, there's the question no one wants to talk about because it's almost too horrible to contemplate, which is, what if NATO doesn't work? What if the United States essentially go rogue? What if they
Right.
say, what, we're going to cuddle up to President Putin, we're going to sign a trade deal with him once we've sorted out this mess in Ukraine, which we blame on President Zelensky, by the way. And you get to the situation where you're thinking, can we rely on them? Is there stuff we shouldn't be talking about in front of them? I mean, there was that FT story a couple of weeks ago about European Commission officials going for the spring meetings, getting burner phones.
Right,
There was a
right.
story in the papers here, if I remember rightly, about 10 days ago about higher security clearance levels being given to documents dealing with some of the trade matters to try and stop the Americans having access to them. So I think, broadly speaking, there is complete American disengagement, the Americans being engaged but us doing more, or the status quo. We're losing the status quo quite quickly, but I think Keir Starmer is trying to keep some sort of American commitment to European security, and I think quite rightly so.
But it is a particular problem for the United Kingdom and maybe alongside Poland and one or two Baltic states where they're kind of the last member state standing, as it were, last European country standing, as it were, in terms of being pro-US still, despite all the evidence, maybe to the contrary, whereas other member states, other European countries don't need much more encouragement to say that's it. If Friedrich Merz, the incoming Chancellor of Germany, is making such a bold reassessment of his own position on transatlantic relations, then surely it's going to be more and more difficult for the UK in this case to carry on with the status quo.
I mean, we could overdo that. I'm sure every single European leader would prefer a world in which this Trump administration can be persuaded to remain engaged in Europe and committed to European security. I don't think there's any divisions on that. We might differ on in terms of the likelihood of that happening, but yeah, differences. And of course, we're particularly exposed in the United Kingdom because we're not in the European Union. And again, I mean, this isn't, if you go back to Brexit, if you think about some of the economic arguments made by the Brexiters, they were arguments about Europe, about the UK becoming a buccaneering trading nation, but they were those arguments were predicated on two assumptions. I mean, one, globalization would continue apace. Two, that our biggest trading partners would remain liberal open economies. And well before Trump, those assumptions proved to be illusory because as a sort of consequence of COVID, deteriorating relations with China and the war in Ukraine, globalization has ground to a halt and even in some cases being reversed. And at the same time, both the US and the EU became more inward-looking, more protectionist, spent, loads of money on promoting and protecting domestic industries. Being outside those continental blocks is a far more uncomfortable place to be now than it was in 2016. So it's a particularly difficult thing for the United Kingdom at the moment because we don't have the sort of safety blanket of the size of one of those blocks backing us up.
Okay, then the final question, and the backdrop to this chat has been the change in Europe, the change in European Union, but the continent more broadly, and how people have these views in the UK about what the EU is about, what they think it's about, maybe not totally well informed, but these ideas seem well entrenched going back decades, way before Brexit. But to the extent that the EU is changing, as we've been discussing for the past 25 minutes or so, is there a case to be made maybe for the UK, the political elite, if you like, certainly maybe not the man or woman in the street, to be more aware of how Europe is changing, the EU is changing, and therefore old tensions, old antagonisms have to be reviewed and revisited.
I mean, there's two bits to an answer. I mean, it's a really, really interesting question because on the surface, actually, in some ways, the way the EU has changed post-Brexit, in some quite profound ways, makes it less UK friendly than it was. I mean, a lot
You're
of things
right,
have happened
yeah.
in the EU that I think any British government, Labour or Conservative, would have tried to veto. I
Yeah.
mean, I can't conceive of the European Commission having the role in defence it has today if Britain was still a member state, for instance. So it's not necessarily the case that the EU changing makes it easier for us. In some cases, it makes it harder. But I think the world is changing. Now, here, there's some interesting sort of messaging choices for the Prime Minister. Let me just take one. On the one hand, over the next few years, we're going to have to spend more on defence than the 2.5% we've pledged. That is going to mean either cuts or taxes. And the argument to do that, I imagine, will be an argument that says the world is changing, we're in crisis, we can't afford to be complacent, we're going to have to make really tough decisions. If at the same time President Trump arrives with all the pomp and circumstance of a state visit and everyone goes out of their way to say how wonderful the relationship is, it kind of undermines the first message. So I think very, very skillful diplomacy can probably square that circle. But I think we shouldn't underestimate the degree to which the changes in the world, not just in Europe, are confronting our government with some potentially really quite tricky dilemmas.
Well, we have to leave it there. There's still quite a few known unknowns, quite a few, no doubt, unknown unknowns. But we have to leave it there. Anand Menon, thank you very much for your time.
Always a pleasure, Paul. Thank you.